morning. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. This is the second part of a two-part interview with Dr. Sekou Franklin, Assistant Professor of Political Science, on the topic of a paper that he presented before the National Association of Black Political Scientists annual conference in Chicago in March about the juvenile justice reform system in the 1990s and the 2000s, and the activism that has sprung up in an attempt to try to reform that system, issues of disproportionate minority incarceration, issues of institutionalized racism, abuse, physical and sexual, lack of hygiene, lack of security, violations of these individuals' right to due process, and so much more. And Sekou is back to talk about some of the activists and the activism that are attempting to combat all of this. Welcome back, Sekou.
Thanks for having me.
We mentioned last time that it's sort of a patchwork, sort of a crazy quilt rules and regulations dealing with juvenile justice, and the activist groups that spring up in response to it are sort of a patchwork as well. So if you can't get all the parts of a governmental bureaucracy that are at least nominally under the same umbrella to communicate and cooperate with each other to make the system run well, how do you get activist groups that come from all different aspects, socioeconomic and political aspects of society, to communicate, cooperate, collaborate?
Well, I should say that that even though there's this patchwork system under federalism of juvenile justice systems, there has been some let's use the term borrowing of tactics and strategies among social movement activists and juvenile justice advocates. And the reason and how that's taken place is, although you have groups over in Louisiana, Maryland, New York, California, typically in social movement circles, you have conferences and you have what's called gatherings. And these conferences or gatherings bring together activists from different places and these conferences allow them to then exchange ideas and strategies for improving the conditions in their particular community. So one of the more prominent conferences that took place in the early 2000s was called a conference called Critical Resistance South. And Critical Resistance South was a second of a series of conferences, the first one taking place in the West Coast, that brought together prison activists, juvenile justice activists, social justice activists, anti-poverty activists. And they allow these individuals to exchange ideas, to continue a dialogue, and to borrow tactics and strategies from each other. In addition, the philanthropists and funders and allies that have supported these initiatives have also served as a kind of a link to kind of tie individuals or bridge these kind of different movements together. So what you're seeing today regarding the juvenile justice community is really not unlike what you saw in the 1960s and 1950s, in which you had a group like Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which brought together activists, even though it was one of the principal organizations of that period of time, but it brought together activists from Nashville, from Howard University, and from North Carolina, and from Atlanta. And they linked these individuals together first through a gathering or a conference, which was organized by social movement organizations and prominent activists. And afterwards, they just continued a dialogue with each other and later on then formed an organization. Yeah.
What motivates these activists to take time out of their professional lives and personal lives to dedicate themselves to this particular cause? Or is the cause so closely related to their professional lives that it is more or less an adjunct of being a lawyer, a social worker, a psychologist, whatever the discipline happens to be?
Well, all the activists I talked to, if you were to take the activists I talked to and place them in the same community in 1960, they would be working on civil rights or voting rights or desegregation campaigns. And so these activists, what motivates them is a belief that juvenile justice says something larger about the way society is organized and says something larger about what the society has to say about justice and humanity. And so what motivates juvenile justice advocates is the same thing, again, that motivated people who joined the civil rights community, that they joined out of a larger concern of about humanity, about social justice, about civil rights. Some joined because, particularly those people who had family members involved in the system, some joined out of a sense of maybe therapy, that they needed some kind of therapeutic relief.
Sort of like a support group?
Support group, yeah. Some joined out of a sense of responsibility. Some individuals would not have even been involved in activism, to be frank with you, had their child or had their family member not been involved in the system at all. So this issue, like many other issues, child welfare issues, mental health issues, this issue became a mobilizing force for many young people. So what I would say to that question, how I'd answer that question is, and again, this is discussed in the social movement literature, is that there are a myriad or various reasons why people get involved in activism. And some people are just driven by kind of a socially conscious or sense of kind of social responsibility. Others are driven by families, their involvement in certain networks. And so there are just a different number of reasons.
How hard is it for someone who, even though their son or daughter might be in the system and being abused in and by the system, someone who maybe lives in public housing, doesn't have a lot of money, has transportation issues, might not even own a car, might have health issues, and have fallen through various aspects of the social safety net, to be an activist when perhaps they are earning an hourly wage, if that, they're members of the working poor, their boss will look at them in a jaundiced way or perhaps even fire them if they take too much time off from work. How hard is it for them to actually get engaged?
Oh, it's very hard because they just don't have any time. In fact, you know, one of the arguments about youth activism is that young people are able to get involved because they have more time and potentially less responsibilities. They don't have to necessarily pay a mortgage. They don't necessarily have to raise a family, although there's some nuances to that, of course. So those individuals who are living in those types of conditions that you mentioned, it's very difficult for them to get involved. And it's difficult for young people to get involved in activism unless you have community organizations on the ground that are intentionally trying to mobilize and organize young people into popular mobilization campaigns. I should also point out that this gets into, again, another debate which emerged as early as the 1930s but reemerged again in the 1960s, I think, in a more clear fashion. And that is that part of the difficulty with getting groups, at least the ones that you mentioned, involved is that there just really hasn't been as much attention by social justice advocates and organizers to mobilize and organize these individuals, because there's the belief that mobilization campaigns are driven by either intellectuals, middle-class organizers,